Anna. Strange and unusual stories from history, literature, myths, and legends.
The Rejected Sorcerer by Jorge Luis Borges. In Santiago, there was once a dean who had a consuming desire to learn the art of magic. He heard that Don Ayan of Toledo was more versed in it than anyone else, so he set out for Toledo to find him. The day that he arrived, he went directly to Don Ayan's house and found him reading a book in a room set apart from his home. The latter received him with goodwill and bade him put aside the motive of his visit until after eating. He showed him to pleasant quarters and told him that he was very pleased by his arrival. After the meal, the dean disclosed to him the reason for his visit and requested that he instruct him in the science of magic. Don Ayan told him that he had divined that he was a dean, a man of good position and good fortune, but that he feared that afterward he would be forgotten by him. The dean gave his promise and his assurance that he would never forget the favor, and that he would be always at his service. With the matter now arranged, Don Ayan explained that the magic arts could be learned only in a remote place, and taking him by the hand, led him to an adjoining room, on the floor of which there was a large iron ring. He then told the servant girl to prepare partridges for supper, but not to put them on to roast until he so requested. Between them, the two men pulled up on the iron ring and descended so far along a curved stone stairway that it seemed to the dean that the very riverbed of the River Tahoe must be over their heads. At the foot of the stairway, there was a cell and then a library, and then a sort of study containing instruments of magic. They began to go through the books and were engaged in this when two men entered with a letter for the dean written by his uncle, the bishop, who made it known to him that he was very sick, and that he should not delay in coming if he wished to find him alive. This news greatly annoyed the dean, on the one hand because of the suffering of his uncle, and on the other because it meant interrupting his studies. He chose to write his apologies, which he sent to the bishop. 3 days later, some men in mourning arrived, carrying other letters for the dean, in which it was learned that the bishop had died, that a successor was being elected, and that it was hoped, through the grace of God, that the dean himself would be elected. They said also that he should not trouble himself to come, since it seemed preferable that he be elected in absentia. 10 days later, there arrived two pages in rich dress who threw themselves at his feet and kissed his hand and greeted him as bishop. When Don Ayan saw these things, he approached the new prelate with great joy and told him that he praised God that such good news should have come to his house. Then he requested the vacant deanship for one of his sons. The bishop made it known to him that he had reserved the deanship for his own brother, but that he had decided still to treat him favorably, and that they should depart together for Santiago. The three went to Santiago, where they were received with honors. 6 months later, the bishop received messengers from the Pope, who was offering him the Archbishopric of Tolosa, leaving in his hands the naming of his successor. When Don Ayan heard of this, he reminded him of the former promise and requested the title for his son. The archbishop made it known to him that he had reserved the bishopric for his own uncle, his father's brother, but that he had decided still to treat him favorably, and that they should depart together for Tolosa. Don Ayan had no choice but to accept. The three went to Tolosa, where they were received with honors and masses. 2 years later, the archbishop received messengers from the Pope, who was offering him the office of cardinal, leaving in his hands the naming of his successor. When Don Ayan heard of this, he reminded him of the former promise and requested the title for his son. The cardinal made it known to him that he had reserved the archbishopric for his own uncle, his mother's brother, but that he had decided still to treat him favorably, and that they should depart together for Rome. The three went to Rome, where they were received with honors, masses, and processions. 4 years later, the Pope died, and our cardinal was elected to the papacy by the others. When Donnian heard of this, he kissed the feet of His Holiness, reminded him of the former promise, and requested the cardinalship for his son. The Pope threatened him with imprisonment, saying to him that he knew quite well that he was nothing more than a sorcerer, and that in Toledo he had been a professor of magic arts. The unhappy Donnian said that he was going to return to Spain, and he asked him for something to eat along the road. The Pope refused the request. Then Donnian, whose face strangely had become younger, said in a firm voice, "Well, then, I'll have to eat the partridges I ordered for tonight." The servant girl appeared, and Donnian told her to put them on to roast. With these words, the Pope found himself in the subterranean cell in Toledo, nothing more than the Dean of Santiago, and so ashamed of his ingratitude that he tried not even to apologize. Donnian said that this trial was sufficient, denied him his share in the partridges, and accompanied him to the street, where he wished him a pleasant trip and dismissed him with great courtesy. The Circular Ruins by Jorge Luis Borges, translated by James E. Irby. And if he left off dreaming about you? Through the Looking Glass, Chapter 6. No one saw him disembark in the unanimous night. No one saw the bamboo canoe sinking into the sacred mud. But within a few days, no one was unaware that the silent man came from the south, and that his home was one of the infinite villages upstream on the violent mountainside, where the Zend tongue is not contaminated with Greek and where leprosy is infrequent. The truth is that the obscure man kissed the mud, came up the bank without pushing aside, probably without feeling, the brambles which dilacerated his flesh, and dragged himself, nauseous and bloodstained, to the circular enclosure crowned by a stone tiger or horse, which was once the color of fire, and now that of ashes. This circle was a temple, long ago devoured by fire, which the malarial jungle had profaned, and whose god no longer received the homage of men. The stranger stretched out beneath the pedestal. He was awakened by the sun high above. He evidenced, without astonishment, that his wounds had closed. He shut his pale eyes and slept, not out of bodily weakness, but out of a determination of will. He knew that this temple was the place required by his invincible purpose. He knew that, downstream, the incessant trees had not managed to choke the ruins of another propitious temple, whose gods were also burned and dead. He knew that his immediate obligation was to sleep. Towards midnight, he was awakened by the disconsolate cry of a bird. Prints of bare feet, some figs, and a jug told him that the men of the region had respectfully spied upon his sleep and were solicitous of his favor or feared his magic. He felt the chill of fear and sought out a burial niche in the dilapidated wall and covered himself with some unknown leaves. The purpose which guided him was not impossible, though it was supernatural. He wanted to dream a man. He wanted to dream him with minute integrity and insert him into reality. This magical project had exhausted the entire content of his soul. If someone had asked him his own name or any trait of his previous life, he would not have been able to answer. The uninhabited and broken temple suited him, for it was a minimum of visible world. The nearness of the peasants also suited him, for they would see that his frugal necessities were supplied. the rice and fruit of their tribute was sufficient sustenance for his body, consecrated to the sole task of sleeping and dreaming. At first, his dreams were chaotic. Somewhat later, they were of a dialectical nature. A stranger dreamt that he was in the center of a circular amphitheater, which in some way was the buried temple. Clouds of silent students filled the gradins. The faces of the last ones hung many centuries away and at a cosmic height, but were entirely clear and precise. The man was lecturing to them on anatomy, cosmography, magic. The countenances listened with eagerness and strove to respond with understanding, as if they divined the importance of the examination, which would redeem one of them from his state of vain appearance and interpolate him into the world of reality. The man, both in dreams and awake, considered his phantom's replies, was not deceived by impostors, divined a growing intelligence in certain perplexities. He sought a soul which would merit participation in the universe. After 9 or 10 nights, he comprehended with some bitterness that he could expect nothing of those students who passively accepted his doctrines, but that he could of those who, at times, would venture a reasonable contradiction. The former, though worthy of love and affection, could not rise to the state of individuals. The latter pre-existed somewhat more. One afternoon, now his afternoons too were tributaries of sleep, now he remained awake only for a couple of hours at dawn, he dismissed the vast, illusory college forever and kept one single student. He was a silent boy, sallow, sometimes obstinate, with sharp features which reproduced those of the dreamer. He was not long disconcerted by his companion's sudden elimination. His progress, after a few special lessons, astounded his teacher. Nevertheless, catastrophe ensued. The man emerged from sleep one day as though from a viscous desert, looked at the vain light of afternoon, which at first he confused with that of dawn, and understood that he had not really dreamt. All that night and all day, the intolerable lucidity of insomnia weighed upon him. He tried to explore the jungle to exhaust himself. Amidst the hemlock, he was scarcely able to manage a few snatches of feeble sleep, fleetingly mottled with some rudimentary visions which were useless. He tried to convoke the college, and had scarcely uttered a few brief words of exhortation when it became deformed and was extinguished. In his almost perpetual sleeplessness, his old eyes burned with tears of anger. He comprehended that the effort to mold the incoherent and vertiginous matter dreams are made of was the most arduous task a man could undertake. Though he might penetrate all the enigmas of the upper and lower orders, much more arduous than weaving a rope of sand or coining the faceless wind. He comprehended that an initial failure was inevitable. He swore he would forget the enormous hallucination which had misled him at first, and he sought another method. Before putting it into effect, he dedicated a month to replenishing the powers his delirium had wasted. He abandoned any premeditation of dreaming, and, almost at once, was able to sleep for a considerable part of the day. A few times he dreamt during this period, he did not take notice of the dreams. To take up his task again, he waked until the moon's disk was perfect. Then, in the afternoon, he purified himself in the waters of the river, worshipped the planetary gods, uttered the lawful syllables of a powerful name, and slept. Almost immediately, he dreamt of a beating heart. He dreamt it as an active, warm secret, the size of a closed fist, of garnet color, in the penumbra of a human body as yet without face or sex. With minute love he dreamt it, for 14 lucid nights. Each night he perceived it with greater clarity. He did not touch it, but limited himself to witnessing it, observing it, perhaps correcting it with his eyes. He perceived it, lived it, from many distances and many angles. On the 14th night, he touched the pulmonary artery with his finger, and then the whole heart, inside and out. The examination satisfied him. Deliberately, he did not dream for a night. Then he took the heart again, invoked the name of a planet, and set about to envision another of the principal organs. Within a year, he reached the skeleton, the eyelids. The innumerable hair was perhaps the most difficult task. He dreamt a complete man, a youth. But this youth could not rise, nor did he speak, nor could he open his eyes. Night after night, the man dreamt him as asleep. In the Gnostic cosmogonies, the demiurgi knead and mold a red Adam, who cannot stand alone. As unskillful and crude and elementary as this Adam of dust was the Adam of dreams fabricated by the magician's nights of effort. One afternoon, the man almost destroyed his work, but then repented. It would have been better for him had he destroyed it. Once he had completed his supplications to the noumena of the earth and the river, he threw himself down at the feet of the effigy, which was perhaps a tiger and perhaps a horse, and implored its unknown succor. That twilight, he dreamt of the statue. He dreamt of it as a living, tremulous thing. It was not an atrocious mongrel of tiger and horse, but both these vehement creatures at once, and also a bull, a rose, a tempest. This multiple god revealed to him that its earthly name was fire, that in the circular temple and in others of its kind, people had rendered it sacrifices and cult, and that it would magically give life to the sleeping phantom in such a way that all creatures, except fire itself and the dreamer, would believe him to be a man of flesh and blood. The man was ordered by the divinity to instruct his creature in its rites and send him to the other broken temple, whose pyramid survived downstream, so that in this deserted edifice, a voice might give glory to the god. In the dreamer's dream, the dreamed one awoke. The magician carried out these orders. He devoted a period of time, which finally comprised 2 years, to revealing the arcana of the universe and of the fire cult to his dream child. Inwardly, it pained him to be separated from the boy. Under the pretext of pedagogical necessity, each day he prolonged the hours he dedicated to his dreams. He also redid the right shoulder, which was perhaps deficient. At times, he was troubled by the impression that all this had happened before. In general, his days were happy. When he closed his eyes, he would think, "Now I shall be with my son." Or, less often, "The child I have engendered awaits me. It will not exist if I do not go to him." Gradually, he accustomed the boy to reality. Once he ordered him to place a banner on a distant peak. The following day, the banner flickered from the mountaintop. He tried other analogous experiments, each more daring than the last. He understood with certain bitterness that his son was ready, and perhaps impatient, to be born. That night, he kissed him for the first time and sent him to the other temple, whose debris showed white downstream, through many leagues of inextricable jungle and swamp. But first, so that he would never know he was a phantom, so that he would be thought a man like others, he instilled into him a complete oblivion of his years of apprenticeship. The man's victory and peace were dimmed by weariness. At dawn and at twilight, he would prostrate himself before the stone figure, imagining perhaps that his unreal child was practicing the same rites in other circular ruins downstream. At night, he would not dream, or would dream only as all men do. He perceived the sounds and forms of the universe with a certain colorlessness. His absent son was being nurtured with these diminutions of his soul. His life's purpose was complete. The man persisted in a kind of ecstasy. After a time, which some narrators of his story prefer to compute in years and others in lustra, he was awakened one midnight by 2 boatmen. He could not see their faces, but they told him of a magic man in a temple of the north who could walk upon fire and not be burned. The magician suddenly remembered the words of the god. He recalled that of all the creatures of the world, fire was the only one that knew his son was a phantom. This recollection, at first soothing, finally tormented him. He feared his son might meditate on his abnormal privilege and discover in some way that his condition was that of a mere image. Not to be a man, to be the projection of another man's dream. What a feeling of humiliation, of vertigo. All fathers are interested in the children they have procreated, they have permitted to exist, in mere confusion or pleasure. It was natural that the magician should fear for the future of that son, created and thought, limb by limb and feature by feature, in 1001 secret nights. The end of his meditations was sudden, though it was foretold in certain signs. First, after a long drought, a faraway cloud on a hill, light and rapid as a bird. Then, towards the south, the sky which had the rose color of the leopard's mouth, then the smoke which corroded the metallic nights. Finally, the panicky flight of the animals. For what was happening had happened many centuries ago. The ruins of the fire god's sanctuary were destroyed by fire. In a birdless dawn, the magician saw the concentric blaze close round the walls. For a moment, he thought of taking refuge in the river. But then he knew that death was coming to crown his old age and absolve him of his labors. He walked into the shreds of flame, but they did not bite into his flesh. They caressed him and engulfed him without heat or combustion. With relief, with humiliation, with terror, he understood that he too was a mere appearance, dreamt by another. The Two Kings and the Two Labyrinths by Jorge Luis Borges. Translated by Donald A. Yates. Men whose word may be trusted, but Allah knows more, relate that in the early days there was a king of the islands of Babylon who gathered together his architects and magicians and ordered them to construct a labyrinth so perplexing and so subtle that prudent men would not venture to set foot in it, and those that did would become lost. This creation was a scandal, for confusion and marvel are properly operations of God and not of man. With the passing of time, there came to his court a king of the Arabs, and the king of Babylon, in order to make fun of his guest's simplicity, had him enter the labyrinth, where he wandered ashamed and humiliated until the setting of the sun. Then the king of Arabia begged divine succor and came across the exit. His lips uttered no complaint, but he said to the king of Babylon that in Arabia he had a better labyrinth and that, God willing, he would make it known to him one day. Then the king returned to Arabia, called together his captains and his lords, and overran the kingdom of Babylon with such bright fortune that he destroyed its palaces, defeated its people, and captured the king himself. He tied the king of Babylon on the back of a swift camel and led him to the desert. They rode for 3 days, at the end of which he said to the captive, "O king of time and substance, and great presence of the century. In Babylon, it was your will to lose me in a labyrinth of bronze with many stairs and doors and walls. Now, the Almighty has seen fit that I should show you mine own labyrinth, in which there are no stairs for you to climb, nor fatiguing corridors for you to explore, nor walls to block your way. Then the king of Arabia untied the cords and abandoned the king of Babylon in the middle of the desert, where he died of hunger and thirst. The Rejected Sorcerer, The Circular Ruins, and The Two Kings and the Two Labyrinths by Jorge Luis Borges. All music and audio production by Bob Familiar. Narration by Jim Bilbro. This has been Ambient Arcana.
Ambient Arcana.